From the National Urban League, this is For the Movement, a podcast that discusses persistent policy and social issues affecting communities of color. I'm Don Craven, Senior Vice President of Policy and Executive Director of the Washington Bureau.
And I'm Kim Atterbury, Senior Director of Communications and External Affairs.
And on this week's episode, we're discussing the automation of the workforce and its impact on communities of color. We're joined today by Spencer Overton, President of the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, and Malcolm Glenn, the Strategic Partnerships and Engagement Manager at Uber. Kim, this podcast has been a dream of the National Urban League now for several months.
It has.
We're always looking for new ways to talk about and talk to the movement. And so I have to say, you and Jordan here at the Washington Bureau, this was your dream to start this podcast. And I'm so glad to finally see it coming true and coming into fruition.
We are too. We are very excited about this podcast. And one of the reasons why we championed it is because, you know, as you know very well, that over the past couple years and really, you know, throughout the history of our story, a lot of our issues aren't told in a narrative that is accessible to us, or it's not elevated to the level of attention that it should receive. So hopefully this podcast will help plug those holes and fill those gaps and not only educate people in and around the movement around certain policy and social issues, but the general public at large.
And I hope people come to see our podcast as the way that we will shed some light on some of the issues they don't always hear about. We read tweets from our commander-in-chief and from politicians all day. We watch CNN or MSNBC or Fox. But we're hoping this podcast goes beyond some of that.
Right.
And we get to some of the stories that they may not hear, they may not read.
Right. And even if it's, you know, a story or a topic that they are familiar with, we hope to drill down a little more and maybe give a different perspective, an angle that is not necessarily covered because the story is not being told by us.
We're going to come back, I know, after the break, and we're going to bring on two very special guests who are going to talk about a very, very important issue.
Right. Right.
And the workforce and automation and
how it impacts people of color.
Yes.
So, yeah, looking forward to talking to both Spencer and Malcolm in a moment. But before we begin, a message from Mark Morial, president and CEO of the National Urban League.
I'm Mark Morial, president and CEO of the National Urban League, and this is your To Be Equal moment. Recently, the Secretary of State of Massachusetts, William Galvin, accused the Trump administration of deliberately sabotaging the 2020 census. And from all indications, we do have a reason to be concerned. The Census Bureau has been without a director since June and remains critically understaffed and underfunded. The Bureau plans to discontinue the practice of hiring non-citizens with legal work permits who've been crucial in the past for communicating with hard-to-reach non-English-speaking communities. The administration has rejected requested changes that could improve the accuracy of the 2020 census, declining to include a combined question format for collecting Hispanic origin and race, or a separate Middle Eastern or North African category on the census form. Recently, the administration's choice for Deputy Director Thomas Brunel, a hyper-partisan gerrymandering advocate with no political experience, withdrew based on pressure from the civil rights community. The census is among the most crucially important undertakings, with far-ranging implications for legislative redistricting, civil rights laws, and distribution of opportunities and government resources. We at the National Urban League have been a powerful advocate for an accurate census and accurate African-American representation in the census for generations. When I served as chair of the Census Bureau's 2010 Census Advisory Committee, I strongly urged the Bureau to expand its paid advertising to areas that have high percentage of hard-to-count residents. I also push for more census funding specifically targeted at Black communities so that we could avoid an undercount. Despite our efforts, the 2010 census, which was a success, missed an estimated 1.5 million people of color. This time, the Census Bureau must make immediate changes so the results of the 2020 census will be better. politicizing the census at the expense of our nation's most vulnerable citizens violates the foundational principles of representative democracy. We at the National Urban League will continue to forcefully advocate for a census that reflects the diversity of our nation and which accurately counts all people wherever they are. I'm Mark Morial, and this has been your To Be Equal moment.
All right. Well, look, welcome back. Today we are being joined by the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies President Spencer Overton and Uber's Malcolm Glenn to discuss the future of work, the tech revolution, and its impact on people of color. First of all, guys, thank you both for being here today. And let's jump right in.
So, as you know, we are living in the technology age. Every day, our lives become more technology dependent and enhanced. Technology is integrated in the way we communicate and the way we learn. It helps us better manage our time, our money, our wealth, our health. It helps us be more effective and more responsive and productive at work. However, the downside of this technological innovation revolution that we're living in is that for many people of color, and particularly those in the skilled workforce, is that it threatens the need for certain jobs and skills. So, Spencer, in simple terms, how will advancements in technology impact the workforce and particularly workers of color?
Well, it's great to be here. National Urban League is great partners at the Joint Center. I'm so excited about the future of work that we're doing together. Automation is going to cut several different ways, right? There's some folks who either the nature of their job will change, right? Let's say a school bus driver. Maybe the school bus driver is no longer driving, but is supervising kids. There may be some people who actually lose jobs. We talk about cashiers, for example, at a store being replaced by a kiosks thing. So there will also be new jobs. One study found that we've lost about 50,000 retail jobs, but places like Amazon have added about 350,000 new jobs in terms of fulfillment centers, et cetera. So what we do know is that there's going to be change and that, you know, folks need to be prepared for that change.
Spencer, let's talk about automation, just right. The term automation, because I've started hearing it more and more, and people are going to start hearing more about it on their nightly news. Right. What is automation? And Malcolm, jump in as well. What is automation for people who don't work in that space?
Right. Well, you know, very simply, automation has been around for a long time, and it's basically using machines and computers to do things that humans used to do, right? So if you think about, we used to be sharecroppers, right? And you have industrialization, and there are fewer folks who are needed on farms and more people who are needed in a factory, and you have the Great Migration. So there we have an example of automation changing labor and changing job opportunities, right? What's different about now, Don, is that with artificial intelligence and data analytics and other tools, different sensors that are out there, things are happening very quickly. Change is happening very, very quickly.
Right. And certainly when you think about automation in the context of driving, and that's certainly Uber's expertise, it's been around for a long time. You think about things like cruise control, lane realignment. You look at something like the Tesla Autopilot program. Automation exists already today. That said, automation also means things like fully autonomous vehicles. Now, we're a long way away from that, but automation is a sort of spectrum, and it's anyone's guess sort of where we are on that spectrum today.
Yeah, when I hear automation, I don't know if I'm supposed to be thinking robots or cruise control, and so that's good. I'm glad you gave us
all of the above.
All of the above, yeah.
And just like the retail example that we talked about, right? It's not a situation necessarily where robots are going to be in as salespeople, but we may change the nature of commerce and have much more e-commerce, and that's going to shift who's actually working at Macy's and Walmart and other places.
Well, we're seeing it, right? I ordered for the holidays. I mean, I know Kim was doing some shopping online.
A little bit.
During her lunch breaks here. But no.
After work.
But you can order something and have it overnight to your home, right? And how does that affect people of color or any, but Americans, but how does it affect people of color when I can simply order something, click a button, and it's delivered right to my door the next day.
And the thing to think about is, remember, you're just not pushing the button and the thing is appearing at your door. There's a fulfillment center, and there are people who are sorting and making sure that the right packages get on the right trucks to get to the right people. And then there are obviously people who are driving those trucks to your door and delivering them ultimately to your doorstep. And so even in the context of automation, there are jobs that take place that facilitate automation that on the back end, there's a lot of people behind it. But on the front end, it's just us pressing a button and getting the package that we need the next day.
And the question for the National Urban League and the Joint Center and other civil rights organizations is, how do we ensure that those new jobs are racially inclusive?
Right.
How do we ensure they look like America, that black and brown folks have a seat at the table in terms of these new jobs?
Well, you lead me to my question. Since 1960, the State of Black America report and the Urban League have been tracking black unemployment. What we know is that African Americans still, even when unemployment is low in the white community, we are still 2.5 to 3 times more likely to be unemployed. And that's been a consistent since 1963 when Whitney M. Young said, we are 2.5 times to 3 times more likely to be unemployed. So to your point, Spencer, how do we do that? I mean, you said something I thought was very profound. We're going to lose some jobs, but we're also going to gain some new types of opportunities. So how does organizations like the Joint Center, the National Urban League, how do we make sure we're in that space or we're part of that change?
Well, let's talk about what we might lose and then let's talk about what do we do.
Okay. Right?
So we ran some numbers at the Joint Center. We found that 27% of black workers in the United States are concentrated in just 30 jobs at high risk to automation.
Mm-hmm. Say that again.
So 27% of black workers, over a quarter of black workers, one out of every four black folks you see working in this United States, they are in one of just 30 jobs. It's high risk to automation. So these are jobs like drivers, bus drivers, right? Or cashiers, or retail salespersons, or fast food workers, or security guards, right? And so there are about 30 of these jobs, and they account for 27% of black workers. They account for about 24% of white workers and about 20% of Asian American workers. So black folks are disproportionately affected, at least in terms of these big jobs, right? So now the question here is, the analogy I like to give, and I'm sorry, I know I weird out, those black women in Hidden Figures, right? Mm-hmm. They knew that the IBM was coming. They were mathematicians working at NASA. And they went ahead and they learned Fortran. And so when the IBM came, they were ready to take over the machines. They were the ones who had good, secure jobs, right? So the question now is, how can we position ourselves so that we can get these new jobs? And there are a lot of different things we need to do. Folks are trying to figure it out. One big piece is significant public-private collaborations here. So you've got mayors, having employers sit down with community colleges and saying, hey, well, what are the jobs you've got coming up and what are the skills you need, and tailoring the community college curriculum so that it actually meets the needs and it's helpful for actual citizens. So really a significant public-private collaboration where folks are working together, and you know, black elected officials and other community leaders, certainly presidents of local urban leagues play a significant convening role in terms of bringing those key players to the table. Economies are local. So us saying, hey, here are the big jobs coming up, may not mean much in New Orleans or Detroit, right? There are going to be particular jobs that are going to be in demand in New Orleans and in Detroit, and they're going to be different, right? And so that's one of the reasons that local leadership is incredibly important in terms of identifying what are the upcoming jobs.
Right. So, Spencer, you touched on that a lot of the jobs that are out at risk are driver driving position. So Malcolm, you know, the Joint Center's report shows that nearly 1 million people in the U.S. work as drivers, such as taxi drivers, chauffeurs, truck drivers. Of that 1 million, more than 215,000 of those driving jobs are held by African Americans. So their report explains that these jobs are high risk of automation as we move toward an automated future and a future that may include driverless cars and vehicles. How does this affect driving services like Uber, which employs a significant number of Black and Latino drivers? Is this good for business? Is this bad for business? How are you educating your workforce?
Yeah, well, Kim, that number is big, you know, both numbers, both the 1 million number and also the 215,000 African Americans number. Spencer, I just want to commend and acknowledge the Joint Center for putting out this research and bringing this to the forefront of such an important conversation. But it's important to realize that in the context of Uber, we're actually really, really small. So people think about Uber as this groundbreaking, world-changing technology. And in a lot of ways it is. But right now, Uber accounts for far less than 1% of all of the miles driven on the road today. Okay. And in the United States, there are about 3 trillion miles driven on the road every year. And so we're far less than 1%. And that even at far less than 1%, we have about 750,000 drivers who are active on the U.S. But the important thing to remember about those drivers is that they're driving part-time, mm-hmm. in between jobs. Mm-hmm. 60%, in fact, of our drivers say that they drive 10 or fewer hours per week. And so this is not their main gig, but something they do to sort of fill in the gaps. And so while ride-sharing has grown exponentially over the last number of years, we're a very tiny part of where we certainly believe we can be. And so if you think about the future, automation can significantly increase the degree to which services like Uber are a part of the transportation pie. So if we're 0.5%, say, today, let's imagine automation causes us to increase by 10x or 20x. Let's say optimistically 20x. Mm-hmm. So we're talking, we're 0.5% now. We can become, say, 10% of miles driven on the road in, let's say, 10 years, just for the sake of argument. Okay, so if that happens, what does that mean? 750,000 drivers, we're obviously not going to be 750,000 times 20 because a lot of those cars are going to be autonomous. Mm-hmm. But probably all of those cars aren't going to be autonomous. You can imagine the scenarios in which autonomous vehicles can't necessarily solve for everyone's needs. Say, for example, you're in a wheelchair and you need someone to help strap you into a vehicle when you're going from point A to point B. Or you're just a person who appreciates a person's knowledge of the city, and they want that sort of white glove experience. So even if you imagine something like 80% of the cars in 10 years are autonomous, and I think that's quite optimistic, but for the sake of argument, let's say 80% of the cars are autonomous on the road in 10 years. We're talking an Uber that's 20 times as large as it is now. And so even if 20% of those cars at 20 times the size and the significance of Uber today are driven by people, you're talking, you know, 60,000 drivers who are still driving cars in the context of an Uber 10 years from now, where 80% of our fleet is autonomous. Hmm. So you're actually talking about more drivers in an autonomous future than you are today. And so, you know, if I were a betting person, I would say that autonomy is going to create more driving jobs because there are still going to be so many opportunities for people who are driving, for people who need that additional assistance, who need or want a person to be in the car. And that's not even taking into account things like autonomous fleet maintenance. What is that going to look like? Mm-hmm. We need to make sure that these cars can operate all day, everywhere, 24/7. And so we need to make sure that there are people taking care of these cars, repairing them when there are issues. And we can make sure that the people who have been driving can be transitioned into this new workforce, taking advantage of an autonomous fleet. And if we're thoughtful about it, I think we can actually create jobs as a result of this far more than there are going to be lost jobs. I think Spencer's right. There are going to be jobs that are lost, but ultimately, I think we have much more to gain if we're thoughtful about it than we do to lose.
Mm-hmm. So a couple quick points. One, it's important from a public policy standpoint that we do things like put these garages in certain neighborhoods, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So that they're not far away from our neighborhoods, but close by and near our neighborhoods from a job standpoint that Malcolm was talking about. Another point is because the population is aging, right? Healthcare is a growing profession, and certainly some of the issues that Malcolm's talked about in terms of people who need assistance. You have your parent who you can't get off of work to get them to the doctor, but you need somebody you can trust who can actually go with them and actually help them. right? And that's very difficult to automate in terms of helping somebody there. I think another thing is, you know, there are about a million heavy and tractor trailer truck drivers, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there are other folks like taxi drivers and chauffeurs, 500,000, industrial truck and tractor operators. These are the people who drive big trucks in warehouses and other pieces. There are over 500,000 of those people. There are bus drivers who are out there, school bus drivers, about 500,000 of those. So there are a lot of drivers. And a final point, you just can't overemphasize in terms of Malcolm, you know, a huge barrier to Black folks in terms of work is transportation, right? And so if we can lower the cost of transportation through autonomous vehicles so that people can either get directly to work or get a ride from their house 2 miles to the bus stop or to the subway or something like that, that's huge in terms of opening up economic opportunity for folks. So this really does cut different ways.
Yeah, Spencer, that point is so, I think, profoundly important, that transportation is oftentimes the gateway to economic opportunity. I think there was a Harvard longitudinal study that was released, I think, 2015, that said that the greatest barrier that a family faces as to whether they can rise out of poverty is not whether there are two parents in the home, whether it's not whether, you know, they have two stable jobs, but it's their commute time. And so if we can fundamentally change both the cost of what it takes to get around and also the amount of time that it takes and give back those efficiencies, we're going to profoundly change the economic calculus for our community. And it's going to, I think, be quite significant.
So what I hear you gentlemen saying is that we should not be afraid of this technology that's coming. I mean, you've made me feel better just sitting here, that we should embrace it. We should prepare for it, right? We should prepare for this and be ready for it.
Yeah, I mean, if we go into this blind and, you know, ignoring this, there are reasons to be concerned, right? But it's also an opportunity. It's also an opportunity for us to move ahead. I've talked about the women in Hidden Figures, but if you look at places like Singapore, South Korea, Estonia, they have like embraced innovation and they have moved ahead rapidly, right? They are the center of their regions from an economic standpoint. Why can't the same thing happen in Gary, Indiana, in Detroit, in New Orleans, in Baltimore, in the Black Belt of Alabama and Mississippi?
So let me ask you that question, Spencer, and I want to ask you that as well, Malcolm, but I want to ask you, Spencer, from the civil rights standpoint, the Joint Center, the Urban League, our other partners, sister and brother organizations, Black folks don't have a great record of being on the forefront of these changes in America, right? We've been behind. We were behind in the Industrial Revolution. We were behind in the Agricultural Revolution. We were slaves, and many are discriminated against. Discrimination still exists. What role are we going to play as the Urban League and the Joint Center in making sure that this revolution, this technological revolution, Black folks aren't left in the dust once again?
I think we got to do a variety of things, Don. Number one, we've got to really reach out to engage with companies, right, and say, hey, we understand that this is coming and you need to give us a heads up and we need to prepare in terms of transitioning folks, and we need to make sure that that's a diverse group of folks who are able to transition, right, and really look for pipelines to new opportunities and be very insistent on that. So that's one big piece. We need to ensure that our elected officials, right, are stepping up to the plate and not thinking in the past, but thinking in the future in terms of future economies. There are, frankly, some natural advantages that we do have. You know, your name suggests it, right, in terms of the National Urban League. There's so many of us who are in urban areas, and if you look at kind of innovation hubs and centers, many of them are in urban areas, right? So there are some opportunities there that we can and should jump on. We cannot be there. Some people who say, hey, let's bring back some coal jobs. And we need to just consciously make a decision. We're not going to go to the past. We're not going back. We are going to focus on the future.
I think this is why the conversation around representation is so important. You know, if the people who are decision makers in the companies, like the one where I work, look like us, then the outcomes for people like us are going to be profoundly better. And so I think we almost need to work backwards, right? We need to set forth what outcomes do we want in this autonomous revolution, in the technological revolution. And from there, we determine, okay, we want to end up as not just beneficiaries or participants, but mm-hmm. we want to be owners. We want to be decision makers. And from there, we can make sure, okay, if we want to get to this place, let's make sure that the people who are making the decisions are in the right places in the company, you know, not just diversity for diversity's sake, mm-hmm. but diversity to make sure that the people who are creating these future technologies are particularly cognizant of what it means for our community. And I think Spencer's right about the fact that the National Urban League is well positioned. You know, just an example from our technology, these autonomous vehicles need to map entire cities before they can even start to begin to think about operating in those cities. It's much easier to operate a heavily populated, dense area where disproportionately African-American people live. And so when you think about just some of the sort of ways that the technology is set up, it stands to benefit us, but it only stands to benefit us if we have people in these companies, in positions of power, in decision-making positions, who also look like us, understand our plight, and represent our interests.
That's a great point.
And this notion of being, as Malcolm suggests, you know, intentional about this and intentional about moving forward. This isn't a situation where you may have a group of tradesmen or plumbers or whatever, generations, they've passed the jobs down and it's difficult for a black person to get in, right? These are jobs that are new, that are emerging. You know, we don't have to go out and say, we're 13% of the population, give us 13. We can say, we know these are going to be big jobs. Let's go in and do as much as we can in terms of dominating that space mm-hmm. as a whole, in terms of acquiring those skills and really nailing that down. So there are these, I just think we have to look at this in terms of opportunities, and change is an opportunity for us to move ahead.
Are there any current policy initiatives or pending legislation that will affect how the tech revolution impacts people of color that we should know about, that we should get behind, people should be aware of?
Yeah, Kim, it's a great question. And there are various pieces of legislation, particularly around autonomous vehicles, that are floating through various legislatures around the country. There's a bill that's been considered in the United States Congress, as well as numerous pieces in state legislatures. But, you know, one of the things that I've been a little bit disappointed that I haven't seen in these pieces of legislation is how they speak to the safety aspect of why we're even investing in these technologies in the first place. Obviously, there's a business imperative. There's lots of money to be made, and that's the reason a lot of these entities and companies are involved. But ultimately, you know, when it comes to driving, 100 people die every day in traffic crashes in the United States alone, 37,000 people every day. And the National Highway Transportation Safety Agency actually did a study a couple years ago that showed that people of color are disproportionately killed in traffic accidents. And the greatest constituency that dies in traffic accidents all across the world, or at least in the United States, mm-hmm. is African-American children. And so when you think about the potential economic impact of saving 37,000 lives every single year and saving lives that are particularly concentrated in our community, particularly in the context of our young people, we need to be talking about safety in the context of every single one of these pieces of legislation. It's not being talked about to this point, but I think we need to be more engaged with lawmakers to make sure that they're cognizant of why this is so important.
And on the federal level, very honestly, a lot of the kind of the mainstream parties, et cetera, don't necessarily have language and tools to deal with this mm-hmm. in terms mm-hmm. of kind of this new world. There are, however, some other countries here that are really, you know, Germany's very good in terms of workforce. There are other countries in terms of the Netherlands where there is just much more focus on workforce development and workers embracing change and unions embracing change and new tools. If you look at population, China, India, right? The way we're going to compete in the future is through automation, just numerically, mm-hmm. right? We have fewer people. Right. But if our folks aren't skilled up and our country isn't investing in those folks, we're not going to be able to compete in terms of India and China. And then there's this local piece. Even if it doesn't happen in Washington, D.C., the role of mayors and county executives and county councils and city councils to really work on terms of workforce and be attractive in terms of saying, hey, our greatest asset is our people and our workers, and we're going to use these workers and upskill them and make sure they have skills and that they're attractive to companies and employers. That's an important role for political leadership.
Spencer, I think you're right. That local piece is key. When you look at our industry, we're not regulated at the federal level. There's no federal legislation around ride sharing. Mm-hmm. Every single piece of legislation in this country that governed our industry, an industry that 7 years ago did not exist, came at the local level, at the state level. And so we were able to create an industry that is fundamentally changed the way that people get around in the United States in 7 years without even talking to the federal government, all through local and state legislation. And I think we can think about that model and be thoughtful about it when we think about this new technological revolution as well.
And very honestly, just political reality, we're very unlikely to have a federal bill that says, okay, here we're going to get all the black folks jobs and skills in terms of the future, right? But we do know that you can have, because of residential segregation,
right,
and black folks being concentrated in particular cities and areas, and that we can ensure that we have good workforce policies in those places, and that those places are attracting businesses and jobs.
Right, and can target places with disproportionate unemployment and, yep, and some of those issues. You made a great point, Spencer, when you said we do have some natural advantages when it comes, yes, to this as well. But look, we could talk about this all day because it's such an important topic, and it's one of the reasons why Kim and I wanted to make sure that we talked about this in one of our first podcasts.
Yeah,
because it is the future. And so what I heard you gentlemen say today is we should prepare for it. We should embrace change. But we got to really make sure that African Americans are not being left behind in this new revolution. So thank you both very much. Malcolm, if I want to get more information about what you do or about what Uber or how Uber is dealing with this, how can I get more information or get in touch with you?
Yeah, absolutely. You can shoot me an email directly, mglenn, M-G-L-E-N-N, at uber.com. I'd love to talk to you about some of the work that we're doing beyond this issue, particularly with great partners like the Joint Center and the National Urban League. We're really transforming, I think, the way that we operate in communities around the world. So we'd love to have that conversation with you.
And Spencer Overton, thank you so much for taking the time to be here today. Your leadership at the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies has been unparalleled and unmatched. You are a true civil rights leader here in the Beltway and outside of the Beltway. Thank you for the research. Malcolm said it. If the Joint Center wasn't putting this out, we just wouldn't know, or we'd find out and it would be too late. So thank you. I applaud you and thank you for your leadership and your research. If we want to find out more about the study and more about the Joint Center work, how do we do that?
JointCenter.org. JointCenter.org. It's our website. All of our info is there. And we really appreciate the partnership, our partnership with the National Urban League.
Agreed.
Thank you.
Before we get out of here, we want to recognize an Urban League affiliate for their hard work to advance our movement. As you know, the National Urban League is a historic civil rights organization with 90 affiliates providing services to over 300 communities and 2 million people in 36 states and the District of Columbia. This week, we're going to give a shout out to one of those affiliates. Kim, who are we recognizing this week?
So this week, we want to shout out the Greater Madison, Wisconsin affiliate, which announced its new commercial driver's license training program to boost employment opportunities for African-American and Latinos. To learn more about the Greater Madison Urban League's great work, visit their website at www.ulgm.com. Great work, Greater Madison.
Absolutely.
As always, you can follow us on all social media at NUL Policy for updates. Be sure to subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, and Google Play. Kudos to our communications and policy team here at the Washington Bureau and our editing team at Podfly. And thank you for listening to National Urban League's For the Movement. See you next week.